Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, June 12th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessica Mendoza, reading for Linda Feldman.
And I'm Peter Greer.
Chagrin Falls is a largely white, affluent town in Ohio. And yes, it has a lovely waterfall. Four summers ago, Monitor staffers stayed there while covering the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. So when Monitor reader David McClurkin sent Linda an article about his town, she took notice. Hysteria in Chagrin Falls over George Floyd protest exposes troubling mindset of white America, the headline read. A local 15-year-old boy had decided to organize a Black Lives Matter rally, and the reaction was shocking. Merchants began boarding up their storefronts. The teen, Chase Tuller, received threats. He canceled the event, but the town kept preparing, apparently for a marauding band of looters, columnist Leila Atassi writes in Cleveland.com. Then, a beautiful thing happened. About 150 people, including Chase, gathered anyway. African-American, white, young, old. A pastor led them in prayer. There was no violence. The message many demonstrators tried to peacefully deliver on Saturday had indeed found a receptive audience in the heart of white America, Ms. Atassi wrote. Chase said he held the event anyway because we can't cancel a movement. But, he added, much work lies ahead. Unusual in this time of unrest have been the countless rallies in small towns across America. Even Vidor, Texas, once a Ku Klux Klan stronghold. At that rally, when a man arrived in a pickup covered with Confederate flags, he was told to leave. For a moment, at least, hate was on the run, writes Texas Monthly. Now to today's stories. Our first story. The Taiwanese are a fervently democratic people. In polls, a resounding majority oppose a one-country, two-systems formula for relations with China, a la Hong Kong. But how do they walk that path?
In China's eyes, Taiwan is a province that ultimately should be fully united with the mainland under Communist Party rule, by force, if necessary. Beijing vows to take over Taiwan, invoking the same one-country, two-systems formula of its Hong Kong policy. It's a plan rejected by more than 85% of Taiwan's people, many of whom are closely watching China's clampdown on Hong Kong. At boisterous marches, they chant cautionary slogans like, "Today's Hong Kong, tomorrow's Taiwan." While China is facing internal pressure to demonstrate strength, no one anticipates steps threatening Taiwan's autonomy anytime soon. Beijing has its hands full. What does worry some experts, however, is that China might misjudge the United States, seeing it as weak and distracted. Others wonder if an American president seeking re-election might be tempted to bolster his increasingly anti-China stance. For now, Taiwan's relations with the U.S. have strengthened. The island's president has deftly inserted Taiwan into the collection of countries condemning China's attacks on Hong Kong's semi-autonomous status. Shirley Can, a specialist in Asian security affairs, says China should avoid miscalculation. If anything, she says, Taiwan's position in the coalition of democracies standing up to China is stronger than ever. This story was reported by Howard LaFranchi and Ann Scott Tyson for The Monitor.
Is yesterday's Rosie the Riveter today's Rosie the Mask Maker? As the pandemic persists, some scholars wonder what will spur more Americans toward collective sacrifice, just as the nation managed during World War II.
Leaders from Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to President Donald Trump have called the coronavirus pandemic America's greatest challenge since World War II. Widespread comparisons between the events, experts say, show how much of the public yearns for a time when Americans displayed such pronounced unity. The virus presents a protracted challenge that requires Americans to look beyond themselves, says James Kimball, professor and World War II expert at Seton Hall University. But whether that shared adversary will give them the sense of shared purpose that developed during World War II, he says, remains to be seen. Few recall the issues that divided the World War II generation, he says. What we remember is the shared sacrifice and the togetherness and the unity. Yet despite partisan divides, limited polling suggests that the majority of Americans see social distancing as necessary and effective. What's more, legions of people like Barb Hammond, a Michigan nurse, have dedicated themselves to the front line. She delayed her retirement this summer to continue work at her hospital. Ms. Hammond says her desire to serve is partly inspired by the selfless example of her mother, a Holocaust survivor, who taught her, "Don't turn anyone away." This story was reported by Noah Robertson for The Monitor.
What's in a name? A rose by any other name may smell as sweet, but for Black Americans, the rendering of their cultural identity matters. Columnist Ken Makin explores the historical fight for a capital B.
One of the first lessons Ken learned when he joined a Black publication was the importance of the word Black. He learned the distinction between Black in terms of race and Black in terms of the color of an item. The capitalization of the B in Black when it comes to race is a cultural, political, and spiritual act. The case for uppercase has roots in African American history and specifically in Black journalism. Ferdinand Lee Barnett, the founding editor of the Chicago Conservator monthly newspaper, championed the cause of capitalizing the word Negro in an editorial that charged that the failure of white people to capitalize Negro was to show disrespect, to indicate a stigma, and to fasten on a badge of inferiority. Civil rights activist and famed sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois made a powerful declaration through a modest footnote to the Philadelphia Negro. "I shall, moreover, capitalize the word Negro, because I believe that 8 million Americans are entitled to a capital letter," he wrote. The capitalization of the N in Negro, of the B in Black, isn't just an act of anger or audacity. It's an act of advocacy. This story was reported by Ken Makin for The Monitor.
Often, opinions on an issue exhibit little change or shift gradually over time. But sometimes attitudes turn quite suddenly. And on racial justice, this looks like one of those breakout moments. Check out our graphic in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. The story was reported by Jake Turcotte and Mark Trumbull for The Monitor. It's the simple pleasures that mean the most in our cooped-up lives right now. Two women in Austin, Texas, have turned their love of baking bread into a way to give back to their community and help others give joy.
Sarah Stevens sits two rooms over from 12 mahogany loaves of sourdough, cooling by a window. "There's a magical sound to bread cooling," she explains. "With a dozen, it's like a small rainstorm." By now, Ms. Stevens and her partner, Libby Goldberg, are accustomed to the sound. Since late March, the duo have been baking and delivering sourdough rounds across Austin, raising money for charities fighting the effects of the pandemic. That's on top of their jobs as personal chefs and caring for their 3 and 9-year-olds. They emphasize that they're one of many small projects trying to give back right now, at a time when governments across the world are straining to respond. "We look at this as a people's project," says Ms. Stevens. "People are showing up for the community, buying loaves for each other, sharing with friends. It's about kindness and generosity and helping that spread. And as long as there's need, they plan to keep baking. I never imagined that people could be so excited about this very basic thing, bread," says Ms. Stevens. "There's that moment of joy and connection in a world that seems to see such a deep lack of joy right now." This story was reported by Whitney Ulick for The Monitor.
Now, commentary on innovation by central banks from The Monitor's editorial board. Central banks are now the leaders in preventing what the World Bank predicts will be the worst global recession in 75 years, a result of pandemic lockdowns. They have generally ripped up old rules and opened their money spigots to keep banks, corporations, and governments afloat with credit. In the United States, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said the Fed has crossed a lot of red lines that had not been crossed before in deploying its vast lending powers. A good example? He promises no hike in interest rates through 2022. The nimble creativity of most central banks may have prevented a total collapse of the global financial system. Now, they must also keep breaking mental barriers and stoking an economic recovery. Mr. Powell points out that the innovations of the rescue efforts have mattered as much as their size and speed of delivery. Compared with past crises, the Fed, like many central banks, knows much better where the needs are. Sometimes the best models of thinking are those that challenge the old models. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us today. Please come back Monday when Linda will be exploring the Trump administration's response to COVID-19 and the larger chronic challenges to American governance. Today's Christian Science spiritual perspective contributor shares how one man adjusted to a new job when it initially didn't look like the right fit. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Noah Robertson.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor, copyright 2020.